You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Edward Hasbrook, who, while traveling across Europe by bicycle, is also organizing a campaign challenging the very future of the U.S. military draft.
Kwe, Nidups, Nidabesks, Aguanu. This is Sherry Mitchell coming to you from my home in Wabanaki Territory, the Dawn Land, the home of the Pana'wupskek, located in and along the shorelines of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And as always, and thankfully, I'm joined by my equally wonderful co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It's a hot and dry, high-altitude desert day out here in Taos, New Mexico. We are in a drought condition, which is actually nothing new, but a few years ago they changed our regular droughts, our mega droughts, to our regular drought. So it's dry, it's hot, climate change is real, don't forget it, folks. But today, we're going to speak with Edward Hasbrook about the future of the U.S. military draft. Most of us know this issue from the Vietnam War anti-draft movement and resistance. It's been an ongoing debate, and now that women are accepted into the military, it's taken a new turn, and we'll let Edward speak to you more about that. When he isn't wearing this hat, he is a travel writer who writes a series called The Practical Nomad. He's been one of the go-to authorities on international travel, an investigative journalist, and here's the spin where he overlaps with us. He also works as a human rights activist and an advisor on travel-related civil liberties issues. So, Edward, thank you for putting on your activist hat with us today on Love and Revolution Radio, and welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Edward, we got introduced because of this work around the draft. And like many of our listeners, I was following a little bit of that story, but there was a lot about it that I didn't know that was going on right now. Will you tell us a little bit about the incarnation of the campaign to end the draft and what's going on that people should know about?
Well, you know, the draft itself, calling people up and forcing them into the military, ended after the Vietnam War. But in 1980, for a variety of basically political reasons in the campaign for the 1980 election, in order to prove that he was macho, could be as macho and as militarist as Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter proposed and Congress agreed to reinstate draft registration, which has been in place ever since, for men. Even at that time in 1980, it was challenged on grounds of sex discrimination because it applied to and imposed a requirement on men but not women. But at that time, the Supreme Court said that it was okay to require men but not women to be drafted because there was a rational relationship between that requirement and the fact that at that time, only men were accepted for combat roles in the military, and the point of a draft would be to get enough cannon fodder for combat if the U.S. Military leadership got in over its head and needed to go to Plan B. Okay, fast forward a few decades, and two things happened. One is that draft registration failed miserably, and we can talk more about that, but so many people didn't register that although a few people, including myself, were prosecuted for refusing to register in a few show trials in the early 80s, quite quickly it became apparent even to Selective Service and the Department of Justice that draft registration was unenforceable because of the extent of the registration. And the attempt to enforce draft registration was abandoned. Nobody's been prosecuted since 1987. But at the same time, or following that more recently, there's been increasing moves toward allowing women into a broader range of military roles, culminating in 2016 with President Obama's decision to admit women to all military combat roles. Now, that clearly undercut, if not eliminated, the legal rationale and justification for requiring men but not women to register for the draft. That left a situation in which, if Congress did nothing, the courts will likely rule that it's unconstitutional to continue to require men to register. That's probably not a situation that Congress will tolerate, and so that left them with the choice of whether to end registration entirely for everyone or to expand it to women. And Congress, as you know, and you were, you know, involved in putting out some information about this, Rivera, at the time, Congress did have a debate about that in 2016, and there were proposals introduced in Congress to go both directions, a bill to end draft registration and abolish the Selective Service System, yay, and a bill to expand the present draft registration so that women as well as men would have to register for the draft and potentially would be sent to the front as compulsory cannon fodder, boo. Well, Congress, in the end, in the run-up to the election, decided to punt the issue into the next presidential administration. What do you do when you've got a political hot potato and you can't decide what to do? You appoint a committee. So Congress in 2016 decided to appoint a presidential commission on military, national, and public service, which would be directed to study the issue not only of whether draft registration should be continued or extended to women, but a larger range of even more disturbing in some ways questions, such as whether the draft should be extended not just to young people for cannon fodder, but to older people, men and women, regardless of age and gender, with skills of particular interest and need to the military, including, and this was spelled out in the legislation, people with foreign language skills, people with medical or healthcare skills, people with science, engineering, and cyber and IT skills, as well as whether there should be some sort of more general compulsory national service.
Well, after the debate in Congress in 2016, rather than reaching a decision to either end the draft registration or extend it to women, Congress instead decided to vote to appoint a committee, which has now been set up, a National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. The bill was enacted by Congress and signed into law by President Obama, and the commission was appointed by President Obama and by congressional leadership jointly at the end of the Obama administration. It has a mandate to report back in 2020, just before the next election. So this has successfully probably put off an ultimate congressional decision on this issue for yet another presidential administration. But it's not a dead issue. Anyway, because Congress is eventually going to have to make a decision one way or the other. Unfortunately, when the decision was made to appoint a commission, not only were they charged with studying whether to end draft registration or continue it, whether to extend it to women, but they were also given the mandate to look into whether there should be a resumption of inductions into the military in general, not just a registration, whether draft registration or a military conscription system should be expanded from young people for cannon fodder to people, older people, men and women with specialized skills of special interest to the military. The legislation specifically named people with medical or health care, nursing or healthcare skills, people with foreign language skills, people with cyber, IT, computer science, engineering, and technical skills among the groups of people to be considered for a draft. And finally, the commission was charged with considering whether there should be some sort of national so-called service program, compulsory service applicable to everyone or to all young people. A wide range of questions. This national commission now is conducting public hearings throughout the country. They have an open call for written submissions to the commission. And again, they're going to be meeting probably behind closed doors and coming up with a set of legislative recommendations that eventually Congress will be considering.
So how are these hearings going? Have you been following the kinds of comments that people are weighing in on? Are they being flooded by pro-military supporters, flooded by peace supporters, not attended at all? What's showing up at the commission meetings?
I think the commission at some level is making a good faith effort to consult the public. But rather than broadly advertised meetings, it's more as though they were going out on the street in some random places and trying to conduct their own man-in-the-street interviews. A lot of their meetings have been behind closed doors. I had to make a Freedom of Information Act request to find out who they'd been meeting with, who they'd been getting briefings from. The emphasis in their meetings and consultations, and to the extent that we know what it is, their research plan, is on pursuing a compulsory national service program. Rather than the other questions. The other reason they haven't been flooded with comments is that the commission, I think, is really actually quite uncomfortable with talking publicly about the draft. They want to talk about service. Now, people who showed up at these hearings, including people with experience in the draft resistance movement, at least three of the people of the 20 people who were prosecuted back in the 80s for refusing to register, have showed up at these hearings and testified. And as one of them, my friend Paul Jacobs said, you can't talk about service and conscription at the same time. I mean, there's a word for compulsory service, and that word is slavery. So really, if you want to talk about service and volunteerism, you have to completely separate that discussion from a discussion about compulsory military service. But the commission really wants to think of being in the military as something good, beneficial, and serving the country. And so they want to bundle together the idea of volunteerism with the idea of conscription. It makes no sense. They've been very reluctant, as I say, to advertise these hearings as being about military conscription. Even less have they wanted to advertise the real specific questions that Congress gave them. Should women be drafted? Should people with language skills? Should doctors and nurses of all ages and genders? Should people with computer science and technical skills? Should they be forced into the military? That's what Congress asked this commission to investigate. The commission probably knows that that's a difficult hot potato and that they would be inundated with people lining up to testify if they publicly advertised discussions on that basis. So they've been loath to, they sort of downplayed that in the advertising. The other thing is that their hearings have been on very, very short notice. Although they're planning months ahead, they're only announcing them a week or two ahead, which makes it very difficult for people who want to attend. But they are having a series of them throughout the country. It's just tricky for people to find out when and where they're going to be hearing.
Edward, I was wondering if you think that the distance or the time lapse between now and the last active draft is going to have an impact on how people view this, especially if there's spin being placed on it related to volunteerism and all of this nationalist fervor around service. Like you said, compulsory service by definition is slavery. And so in this case, it's slightly different because our soldiers are getting paid. So it's kind of like an indentured servitude. But it's not really that much different than the what's going on with the private profit-driven prison systems, where it's looked at as the modern-day form of slavery. And so when we think about all of those things and we think about the spin that's being placed on it and the distance within people's memories about the last active draft, what can be done in order to help people understand the seriousness of conscripted service? And how can that be really clearly outlined for individuals that we're not talking about service to our communities, we're talking about service in military interests. And so do you have a platform that is helping people to close the gap between the last active draft and today and helping to educate them about what the truth is related to the type of service that's being promoted here?
Well, certainly there's a lot of information for people who are thinking about volunteering for the military that does give information about what people are really getting into. And there's, you know, a lot of issues with lies that recruiters tell to get people to go into the military. Obviously, you need a draft to fight a war that not enough people are willing to volunteer to fight. So that's clear. In terms of the history, I think there's an odd thing that the invisibility of draft resistance and the issue of the draft over the last 35 years is a direct result of a unrecognized but really profound success of draft resistance in the early 1980s in the depths of the Reagan administration. The reason we don't have a draft now, and the reason why for 35 years we've had this stalemate where draft registration has continued but nobody is being drafted and nobody is being prosecuted, is that millions of people quietly ignored the draft registration requirement in the 1980s, and it became clear even to the Selective Service System, even to federal prosecutors, that draft registration was unenforceable. Now, there was no face-saving way to repeal the draft registration requirement without admitting that it hadn't worked, and without Congress and the Pentagon admitting that military policy is constrained by the willingness of the citizenry to carry out orders. And, you know, politicians do not like to admit that they have limited power, that the real power rests with the people. This is fundamental Gandhian analysis of how power works, how power is wielded, and who has the power. But there was no face-saving way to end draft registration, so it's continued in this stalemated way, even though, equally invisibly, it continues to be the case that the majority of young people, young men subject to draft registration, violate the law, whether they realize it or not. You know, people probably don't even know that every man in the United States is supposed to not only register when they turn 18 with the Selective Service System, but report to the Selective Service System every time they change their address until they turn 26. Now, compliance with that is virtually nil, so that most of the addresses on the registration list are obsolete, and if there were to be a draft, most of the induction notices would wind up in the dead letter office. So there has been continued resistance, but it's been quiet. The other thing that happened was that back in the 1980s, when there were a few show trials, there were people like me who were active organizers, invisible organizers, and people got the message that there was not only safety in numbers in resisting draft registration, but there was safety in silence. So the government succeeded in not in stopping the resistance, but in silencing it. And so because of that, it hasn't had the level of public visibility that enables people to realize how important it is. And I think the peace movement was, failed to adequately claim the victory of having stopped the effort that was made in 1980 to bring back the draft. You know, the people who brought back registration in 1980 certainly intended to move to a draft, and that they didn't is a direct result of our resistance.
Well, I really appreciate that you took the time to so clearly articulate the strategies of resistance, the history of the resistance in terms of the draft, so that people can become better acquainted with both how the organization happened and its success. Both stories, I think, are lacking from a lot of people's conception on this issue. I wanted to ask about the expansion of the draft to, I guess I could call them non-combat positions or support positions. That is this a maneuver to make the military more palatable to people who might otherwise resist? I mean, I would imagine that if you think you're being drafted to be cannon fodder, as you so aptly put it, there'd be a lot of resistance. If they can get away with saying, oh, well, we might just draft you to do, you know, to roll bandages and build software, then that people might actually go along with that idea. How does that shift affect people's willingness to accept a draft or not?
I think you're very much right that it makes it more palatable to people. You know, the reason even that, you know, people who jump through a whole bunch of hoops and fit a very narrow definition of conscientious objector are allowed to do non-military alternative service is not to respect their beliefs. It's because that helps to co-opt them into not resisting more actively, and it helps makes the institution of the draft more generally acceptable. And I think it's precisely because politicians think that a compulsory national service scheme that includes either an option to do civilian work or an option to do military work, but where even the civilian work is still work defined by the government as what the government wants you to do, will be more politically palatable. And I think there are two problems with that. One is that most jobs in the military and in support of the military aren't jobs on the front line. They aren't jobs shooting people or even flying the drones that shoot people. Most draftees have always done support work, logistics work. You know, that's part of what an institutionalized, industrialized, mechanized, organized military machines are about. It's not just a few people at the front lines. It's a whole institution that requires large numbers of people in support roles. And so people shouldn't delude themselves that being in support of that is not military. You know, even you look at healthcare, and the reason that the military needs lots of doctors and nurses is, of course, that war kills and wounds. And the defined role of medics in the military is not to heal people. It's to get them able to go back into combat as soon as possible. That's the goal of military medical care. So there's this problem that it's still going to put people into the military. The other problem is that even for me, at least, while I'm a pacifist and would oppose a military conscription system on that grounds, I'm also not a supporter of slavery for any purpose and would oppose a conscription system even if it were detached from the military. But this isn't detached from the military. What's being contemplated is a system that would try to make military conscription politically palatable by bundling it with some sort of compulsory, government work for other purposes. And we see around the world that there are many countries where conscript armies are used for other kinds of, you know, to get cheap labor to do other things that the government wants to do rather than actually hiring people and paying them a living wage to do these things, which goes back to another set of questions about why things like teaching and a variety of other government paid service work are so underpaid.
I just want to follow up with a question about, like, say, the Peace Corps. You know, we could argue that what if we had 100% conscription into the Peace Corps, which is a, you know, parallel to being in the military, but for service projects around the world. And there, you know, we have AmeriCorps, Vista Corps. These are domestic variations. Is the problem in your mind simply the military aspect? Is it you talked about the slavery aspect, but is there a framework in which, you know, requiring citizen contribution to projects of service could be a good thing?
Well, what is service? I think service is something people have to define for themselves. It's not Service is not following orders. We got enough people who follow orders. We need more people who know not to follow orders when they're wrong orders. That's what we need. And so, a system that's based on equating service with doing what the government tells you what to do has a name also. That's called fascism.
I think that it's interesting that we're having to have this discussion out of a necessity to protect our future generations from this ongoing aspect of war for profit. And that's really what it kind of comes down to. At the same time, we see that there is an incredible benefit to having some type of service requirement for our young people. There are service requirements in universities that are necessary for graduation. There are service components in some high school programs that are required. A number of other countries around the world have some type of service component. And so how do we work on instilling within the population some type of commitment toward serving their fellow citizens in a way that doesn't cause this type of conscription or fascist kind of leaning model that really amounts to some type of indentured servitude or slavery.
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, that's exactly the kind of question that the National Commission on Service has been trying to focus its attention on, and they have heard from people involved in the Peace Corps and AmeriCorps, and they have talked to people at colleges and universities that have these kinds of so-called service requirements. And some of the witnesses, I've actually gone to three of the commission's, I guess at this point, five public hearings, ones in Denver, in Boston, in Nashua, New Hampshire. They've also had ones in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Pensacola, Florida, kind of a motley selection of people. They're going to have other ones going forward in, in Chicago, in Memphis, in Waco, Texas, in Los Angeles. But anyway, I mean, at some of these hearings, they did hear from people who'd been at high schools and colleges with so-called service requirements who testified that the commission should not recommend this kind of program, but because when this was a compulsory thing, people didn't see it as service. They just saw it as something they have to do so that they could check off the box so that they could graduate. And it instilled no ethos of service. Service has to come from within. And the reality is that people want to do useful work. And what I said in my testimony to the commission is that if you want to enable more people to serve humanity, to serve their own goals, to serve something other than having to make money or satisfy the government, then the biggest barrier to service is actually student debt, which effectively makes people indentured servants of capitalism when they get out of college or get out of federally funded job training, where they have these huge debts that constrain what jobs they can take and force them to take higher paying jobs rather than being able to do things that might actually have more public value but that don't pay as well. So if you want to enable people to serve, the first step is to get rid of debt financing by recognizing that education is a human right that should be available to everyone and not tied to military or other service to the government, so that people could get out of college or be trained for a job and then have the freedom to choose what they want to do without having to, you know, get on this treadmill of trying to pay back their student loans.
The other problem with student loan debt is that there is a service component for repayment of student loan debt. I'm certainly someone who was a single mother and went to law school later in life and now am burdened with student loan debt to the point where I can't even achieve the status that I held before I went to law school as a homeowner because my debt to income ratio is so skewed because I choose to do public service work. And so the programs that are established to help with student loan debt are also riddled with difficulty. And so you can serve for 5 years and then they can come back and tell you, oh, I'm sorry, but none of that counts because you forgot to file this one piece of paper with your large application to have your service recognized to forgive your student loan debt. And so I think that, you know, the profit margin that's associated and the profit aspects associated with war, the profit aspects associated with things like prisons for profit, with student loan debt, that these have all been privatized and tied to, these economic markers that benefit very few people and create this feudal system that we're all living under. So how do we alleviate that? How do we move beyond that to something different? Is there a way that you're aware of that we can actually move beyond those types of models and shift towards something that's actually going to work for the larger part of the population?
Hey, and we'll come right back to that question after a quick break for a station ID and your much-loved Nonviolence Minute on Love and Revolution Radio. Love and Revolution. Thank you. On this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to take a page straight out of the anti-draft resistance that Edward Hasbrouck has been talking about in the 1980s that rolled back the advancing of the draft to the status that it's at now. Nonviolent resistance has always been a part of anti-draft campaigns, which have come up over and over again throughout the years. This piece is by Denise Levertov. It is called A Speech for Anti-Draft Rally, D.C., March 22, 1980. As we know, poetry has been a large part of resistance movements, and this piece seemed very apropos to this week's conversation. Not only do draft-age people mostly not know how wars become almost pastoral compared to the new war, the kind in which they may find themselves, while the usual pink-faced men, smooth-shaved, overfed, placed in power by the parents of those expendable young, continue to make the decisions they are programmed for. But also, they know nothing at all about radiation, nothing at all about lasers, nothing at all about how the bombs the Pentagon sits on like some grotesque chicken caged in its nest and fed cancerous hormones exceed and exceed and exceed Hiroshima over and over and over in weight, in power, in horror of genocide. When those draft-age people say, if there's a war, I'll go, they don't know. They would be going to kill themselves, their mamas and papas, brothers and sisters, lovers. When they say, if there's a war, I'll get pregnant, they don't seem to know that war would destroy that baby. When they say, I'd like to fight for, quote, freedom, for, quote, the free world, for, quote, America, for whatever they think they'd be fighting for, those children with braces on their teeth, fears in their notebooks, acne on their cheeks, dreams in their inarticulate hearts, whom the powerful men at their desks designate as the age group suitable for registration. They don't know they'd be fighting very briefly, very successfully, quite conclusively, for the destruction of this small, lurching planet, this confused lump of rock and soil, ocean and air, on which our songs, cathedrals, gestures of faith and splendor have grown like delicate moss, and now may or may not survive the heavy footsteps of our inexcusable ignorance, the chemical sprays of our rapacious idiocy. Our minds that are big enough to imagine love, imagine peace, imagine community, but may not be big enough to learn in time how to say no. Once again, that is an excerpt from a poem by Denise Levertov, a rather well-known poet who was involved in resisting the Vietnam War and wrote this poem for an anti-draft rally in D.C. on March 22, 1980. We'll post the link to the whole poem in our show notes, which can be found on Podomatic and on our new SoundCloud profile under Love and Revolution Radio. And now let's return to speaking about the anti-draft movement's current incarnation with Edward Hasbrouck.
Well, you know, you're sort of asking, you know, how do we make a revolution, which is a big question, and I commend you for the work you're doing in that direction. I think at the small level, you know, getting people to realize that when the government says jump, you don't have to jump, that we have power, that we have more power than we know, as my dear mentor Dave Dallinger titled one of his books, we have more power than we know or than the government tells us to influence the course of events. Making people more empowered to take control of their own lives is a step in that direction, certainly. Getting them to see that. Obviously, you know, student debt is an important issue. There's a very interesting parallel in that back in the 1960s, the Selective Service System saw the draft mechanism and the exemptions from the draft and explicitly defined it and trained its staff that this was a channeling system. in which even those who didn't go into the military but who were deferred because they were doing essential war work or other things were being steered into what the government thought was the way they could best serve the war machine, even if they didn't go into the military. Well, today, we don't have conscription, although we do still have draft registration, but the channeling of what you can do to get your student loans forgiven, et cetera, et cetera. Student debt serves a similar function in channeling people's choices to the role that the draft played in the 60s and 70s.
I think it's really important, as we're talking about that, to really keep in mind that another thing that's dramatically shifted in present times is that we don't just live in a democratic government. We never did, really. But what we really are struggling with now is the intense collusion of neoliberalism, of the corporate-controlled government structures. And so I think when we're talking about issues like the military draft or student debt, it really becomes one and the same in terms of mechanisms of, as you were saying, Ed and Sherry, constraining the citizen, the individual, the person, to service in the goals of the corporate state, basically. I wanted to ask about, you know, what we end up with if we don't have a draft. And this is kind of a tricky question because currently we don't have an active draft, but the people who are sort of de facto drafted into volunteering, as we say, for the military, enlisting in the military, generally come from lower income backgrounds. That they're feeling like the military is their only option to get an education, to get a job, to get out of poverty. And one of the concerns I have potentially about, you know, about shifts around the military is that's not an appropriate way for the military to get its cannon fodder and support staff either. So I suppose one answer is to abolish the military, which I guess I would be possibly in favor of. But what do we do to make sure that the way that the military recruits, whether it's compulsory or it's voluntary enlistment, is just and fair?
Well, I, you know, as a pacifist, I'm not going to argue that there is a just way of setting up a machinery for killing people. But I would answer in a very different way. I'm certainly not a supporter of the current poverty draft, but I don't want to get into a debate about, you know, which way of, you know, whether to use sort of a capitalist structure of monetary incentives to force people into the military or, you know, whether actually to go and, you know, put people in the military under threat of being in prison as opposed to under threat of being broke. Neither is a good system. So I think the question I would want to ask is, how do we rein in the military? And my goal as a draft resister was never just to keep myself out of the military. I didn't want to go in the military. I probably wasn't going to be drafted even if I registered. And besides which, I could have just quietly ignored registration, not been visible in public about what I did, and would never have gone to prison for resistance. The reason I resisted and did so actively, and what I think is the goal I would like to see for a draft resistance movement today, is to prevent the draft so that the military will be forced to scale back its plans. Right now, the draft isn't plan A. You know, everyone, politicians and the Pentagon will say, and it's true, we don't want a draft. And it's not even probably plan B. Plan B is, you know, the National Guard and reserves. Plan C is mercenaries, so-called civilian contractors. Plan D perhaps is proxy forces from our allies. You know, the draft is probably down there around plan F for fallback, but it's still the last resort that the military believes that there's no limit to how many troops it can throw into the breach because ultimately, if the war gets larger, it has a draft. So the real question is, if the military had to admit and war planners had to admit that there was some fundamental limit to how many soldiers they had available, then how and to what degree would they have to scale back the extent to which they're either engaging in war or risking war or risking the escalation of war. So the goal of draft resistance is not so much to reform the way that they get people for the military, it's to place a direct constraint through popular direct action on the ability of the government to wage war in the first place.
So let me follow up on that, just that, you know, we said at the beginning of the show that this commission is was commissioned to study largely the ability to add women to the draft. Now, they've chosen to kind of shift that framing because it's too hot button issue. But how does the desire to conscript women into the military relate to the potential for resistance? As we saw during the anti-Vietnam War movement, the draft was actually a big mobilizing factor of people resisting the war. So if they came clean about women, that they want to put women on the roster too, do you think there would be massive outcry and massive resistance to the draft and potentially to the larger war machine?
Absolutely. I mean, if it's absurd to think that women would be more willing to sign a piece of paper saying they're willing to kill or be killed on command than men have proven. If the draft proved, or draft registration even, proved unenforceable for men, it's clear that it would prove unenforceable for women. This is one of the key things that this National Commission needs to hear. They need to hear from women who say, we would not go if drafted. They need to hear from people who say, we would support our sisters, our daughters, our friends, our lovers, who would not go if they were drafted, who would not sign up if they were required to register. And the commission needs to understand that this isn't just a choice of what they would like. This is about facts. They need to recognize that, like it or not, the willingness of people, including clearly the willingness of young women, as well as perhaps older women in nursing and medical professions and these other professions who might be targeted for a special skills draft, the willingness people, including women, to register, to be drafted, needs to be recognized as a fact that would constrain it. It makes no sense to talk about a draft that would be unenforceable, that couldn't be carried out.
One of the things that I think is really interesting is that there's a whole contingent of peace activists who actually support the draft. And their reasoning for supporting the draft is that they want to equalize the playing field. So they want the sons and potentially daughters of the extremely wealthy individuals who are making the decisions in our Congress to actually have to be conscripted like everyone else. And so when we start thinking about issues around the draft, I read this thing that said, you know, the right movement moves us in the right direction. And so when we start forcing the issue of looking at a draft, one of the things that could potentially come out of that is solidarity movement around potential nonviolent actions amongst individuals who had never really been active in that arena before. And so I think that there's, you know, a lot of possibilities on both sides of this issue for creating discussion that might move us in the right direction. And I think that we have to be conscious of how our choices, and we're in this just at water society where we often don't think about the long-term ramifications of the choices that we're making. So, you know, how do we make decisions around this that actually move us away from this institution of war? And I'm not sure how we do that. You know, I'm interested in knowing if others, specifically you today, Edward, have ideas about how do we engage this mechanism, engage this process, this dialogue in a way that moves us in the right direction. How can we shift away from the institutionalization of war when we even have individuals from the peace movement who are supporting a draft? Not thinking about how that actually deepens and our involvement with ongoing war.
Well, I think the draft has always been, for those who were subject to a consciousness-raising experience, that helps people think about, even for those who aren't subject to it, who have, you know, friends, family members, lovers, whatever, who are subject to it, it makes people think about their own direct relationship to war. And of course, whether we're fighting, whether we're wearing a uniform, if we're paying taxes to the government, we are playing a role in the war machine as Americans. And so I think it's important to bring that to the forefront. But to those in the peace movement who support a draft, you know, the arguments that you suggested, which are real, people do say this. I think, you know, saying that, well, if there were a threat of a draft, it would, you know, cause more people to protest is sort of like saying, well, if the cops were shooting more white people as well as people of color, then more people would be protesting about police violence, which is true, but that's not a reason to advocate that the police start shooting more white people as well as people of color. It's a reason to advocate that we reduce the police force and demilitarize the police. So that's a big piece of it, I think.
You know, I think it is important to talk strategy, and I think that's a good analogy. And I think there's a number of issues that approach of, you know, should we shoot our foot to say we need to go to a doctor comes up in. So it's good to think about it. I'm a little curious to talk about, you know, the commission, what's left in terms of their hearings, how many more they're going to do, and the timeline of action for people who do want to get involved and do want to speak up and make their voices heard. I feel like it's a pretty big thing to realize that the entire draft, the entire concept of the draft is back on the table, whether we get rid of it altogether or we expand it to everyone. That's a rather large issue that would basically affect all 320 million of us. Well, I mean, you could take out the kids from that number. But, and then also very much affects, as you said, the willingness of the powers that be to wage endless, massive, intense imperialistic wars around the world. So what's next for the effort, and how do people get involved?
Well, there's a few things that are going on. The commission has a number of hearings scheduled. They've released rough dates and approximate locations, but not the exact details. But there will be opportunities for people, as I said, in Memphis, Waco, Texas, if you happen to be there, the Chicago area, and Los Angeles for between now and September for those hearings. The commission's own website is at inspire2serve.gov. That's inspire2serve.gov, which gives you a feel for where they're coming from. And not only do they have that rough schedule, and they'll be posting details of the further hearings, but there's a form on that site that you can fill out to submit short written comments, or you can send by email comments of, you know, longer written statements or testimony or documents that you want them to look at. We don't really know how much weight that will carry. I know it's difficult for people, but people who are in those locations where they're having hearings, because they've been so sparsely attended, even a few people showing up and even a few people specifically saying, we will not go, we will resist, we will support those who will resist. You need to abandon the idea of compulsory service and report back to Congress that, like it or not, it's impossible. That could have an impact. For people who don't happen to be in one of the places where they're holding hearings, the opportunity for written comments is open through the end of September of this year. So there is a window, but do it sooner rather than later. Get your friends to do it, even if you just fill out the one-liner. And if you want to say, I would resist, but you don't want to, you know, name yourself and become a target for selective prosecution, you can submit anonymous comments as well. So there's that opportunity to be heard. Talk to your friends, talk to people, let them know that this is happening. You know, I want to go back to one other thing. You mentioned, you know, you mentioned kids. You know, I got involved, not surprisingly, in this movement back in the early 80s as a young person whose background was in the youth movement. And, you know, while the draft has usually been limited in most places to men, but the one thing that's most characterized who gets picked out by the draft is that it's almost always been a draft of young people. Even when people talk about universal service, they're talking about everybody of a certain young age. The draft is one of the ultimate expressions of governmental ageism in our society. And when, for example, people say, well, we should have a draft because that would mean that the sons and daughters of members of Congress would be potentially getting drafted. That's sort of like saying, well, we should punish people's children for the act of their parents, or we should kidnap their children and hold them hostage to get their parents to do the right thing. I think that needs to be categorically rejected as completely illegitimate, gross ageism. People need to be held responsible for their own actions. If you want to, you know, if you want to make politicians, you know, act differently, go after them. Don't go after their kids.
I want to thank you for saying that, Edward, because I think that that's what oftentimes happens in a lot of our movements, that there is this willing sacrifice that people are willing, you know, willing to make in order to have their goal achieved, which often involves bringing in those who are innocent and punishing them for the crimes of their parents. We're certainly seeing evidence of that right now in the detention camps where children are being taken away from their parents for the alleged crimes of their parents. And so I think it's really important at this point in time to talk about how we oftentimes will avoid holding those who are most responsible, and will shift that burden to the more vulnerable populations that are attached to them. And so, you know, we've already talked about the poverty draft, that, you know, there is this very real scenario going on where, you know, there's this sense of requirement to serve in the military in order to be able to pull yourself out of poverty. And so in the discussions that you've had and some of these meetings that you've attended, have there been things that have surprised you that have come up in the discussions that aren't the, you know, kind of rote things that we're expecting to hear, that either support the continuation or reinstatement of a draft or expansion of a draft, even that haven't been part of the discussion previously?
Well, interestingly, you know, a couple things have been themes. One is how many military members of the military who did volunteer, you know, many of whom believed in what they were volunteering for, whether or not they still believe in it when they come out. And certainly there have been a number of members of groups like the Veterans for Peace and Iraq Vets Against War who've showed up at these hearings. But it's interesting to see how many people who are in the military don't support a draft, don't like that for a variety of reasons, including they themselves realize that conscripts don't make very reliable soldiers. I mean, slave labor is really inefficient as a way of doing anything, even as a way of killing people, because, you know, slaves will, it's the right and duty of slaves to slack off and do as little as possible of what they're being ordered to do, and to try to sabotage those who have enslaved them. And people who are in the military, I think, at some level get that. So they don't really want to be in the foxhole with a conscript. That's been one theme. A second theme, as we mentioned earlier, has been really clearly the effort from people who've testified in front of the commission to separate out and to get the commission to separate out the issue of service and volunteerism from the issue of militarism and conscription. And it's clear that the commission is very, very uncomfortable with that, because the task that they've been given does, in fact, bundle those things together.
Well, it sounds like that's one of the big challenges that we face as a peace movement, or as the movement to abolish or end the draft, is to separate those. It's also an issue the peace movement faces nationwide around just the glorification of war and the idealization of soldiers, a situation that many of them themselves object to, whether they're veterans for peace or not. There's a lot of soldiers who know that the wars are waged for profit, that they're not really about what they're said to be about, and that the rhetoric of the military does not line up with the reality of the military. Ed, we are pretty much at the end of our show, and it's been such a great conversation. I'm left with a bunch more questions and too little time to ask them, but the important one to ask right now is, if the listeners are out there and they want to get involved, we've talked about the inspiredtoserve.gov site where they can leave a comment, but you also have a website that has a ton of information on it. Would you let the listeners know where they can find that and then also any other resources they might want to access?
Well, our website is resistors.info. That's resistors, plural, .info. And that has links to, you know, how you can submit comments to the commission, information about the history of registration and the draft, as well as advice for people who today are faced with the ongoing requirement to register for the draft, as well as, you know, it's got, you know, leaflets that you can print up and hand out to your friends and other materials you can use. So again, that's resistors.info.
Edward, thank you so much for joining us today and for helping us to, in many ways, begin this really important discussion on this platform. And I think that it's important for people to start thinking about some of these things that are not right in their periphery. There are so many challenges that we're facing right now that people tend to stay in their own silos within their work. And the purpose of the show is to help us all see the work that's being done across the board. So we have about 1 minute left. Is there a final word that you would like to offer to our listeners?
Well, thank you for having me on and for, you know, raising these issues. I think it's easy to see this as something that's really kind of, you know, a low priority because who cares? It's not just that there's a threat of a draft. It's that resistance to the draft has been a tremendous victory. We need just a small step further to follow through on that, to get draft registration ended, to abolish the Selective Service System, and most importantly, to finally force the government to acknowledge that our people power limits the extent to which they can wage war.
Thank you so much, Edward. We really appreciate you spending the time with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for all you do.
Thanks this week to our guest, Edward Hasbrook, and thanks to Sherry for her usual excellent level of commentary. You can find the links to all the great places to find out more on our podcast pages and our show notes. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find that great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd also like to thank my wonderful co-host, Rivera Sun, for her ever-engaging and brilliant vision that she brings to the show and to our discussions each week. If you enjoyed this show today, you might also enjoy following me on my website, sacredinstructions.life, or on my Facebook page, facebook.com/sacredinstructions, where I share a great deal of information on the Love Revolution and on our roles as spiritual activists and change makers. The link to those pages can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast and through the Love and Revolution Facebook page. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and you can ask your local radio station to broadcast it. All you have to do is give them a call and ask them to put us into their rotation. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com, or on the Love and Revolution Facebook page. We are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. Edward Hasbrook has told us that it's time to push back against the draft. So, listeners, maybe you'll take his message to heart and speak up, speak out, and help end the draft by the time we talk to you next week.